You're listening to the Effective Statistician, episode number 51, Data Science or Just Statistics on Non-Medical Data, A New Horizon for Statisticians, an interview with Steve Ruberg. Welcome to the Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector designed to improve your leadership skills, widen your business acumen, and enhance your efficiency. The PSI conference is coming up. It happens on the 2nd to the 5th of June in London, and the early bird rate ends on March 20th. So register now at psiweb.org. I have already registered and will present there as well. So come to London and let's meet there. It's really the best conference I know for statisticians in the pharma or CRO I can think of. So register now. In today's episode, we'll talk about data science and what statisticians within pharma can do about that. And we talk about data science beyond medical data. And for that, we have probably the best speaker that I can know of. It's Steve Ruberg. He was a keynote speaker at last year's conference in Amsterdam, and he did a very, very good presentation about it. Overall, there's a long tradition of statisticians working on clinical studies as well as other related data, like preclinical data, observational data, but now we have this advent of big data and data science, and so there's a lot of pull from the business side of pharma to employ statistical approaches there. So in this episode today, we talk about whether this is an area for medical statisticians to enter, whether you as a originally medical trained statisticians can enter into this field, and what you should know about that in terms of getting into there, whether it's something for you, how you can prepare in terms of these upcoming changes in the overall industry. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to special interest groups, the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician, and this time it's just me without my co-host Benjamin, but I have a very, very good guest here, Steve Ruberg. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Alexander, and thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this.
Yes, it's awesome to have you on this podcast sponsored by PSI, especially as you have given a great keynote lecture at the PSI conference in Amsterdam.
Well, I very much enjoyed that entire PSI conference, and I would highly recommend it to any statistician working in the pharmaceutical industry. It was a wonderful way to learn, to make more connections, broaden my network, and have some real fun as well. So thanks.
Yeah, it was really an awesome conference. But before we go into a couple of things that you actually also covered in your keynote there, let's introduce yourself a little bit first.
Okay, my name is Steven Ruberg. My schooling started with mathematics and ultimately led to a PhD in biostatistics. I spent over 38 years in the pharmaceutical industry, working in all aspects, I would say, of the pharmaceutical industry, from preclinical statistics through clinical development, and ultimately in my career getting into business statistics, if you were, or commercial analytics, which led to other areas of the company that I worked for outside R&D. The last 18 years of my career were spent at Eli Lilly and Company, where I held various roles, but the last 10 years I was the scientific leader and Distinguished Research Fellow for Advanced Analytics within the company.
Yeah, and within this time, you actually worked also beyond the medical data. You were quite instrumental in moving forward the business analytics part, because that is a part that is more and more demanded in the world. I'm not sure. My perception is sometimes other industries are a little bit ahead of the farm industry in terms of that. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say this, that with the kind of the data revolution that started, you know, around the turn of the century, the explosion of internet business and the collection and capturing of electronic transactions, I guess I would say the business world discovered in a roundabout way, or they kind of came through the back door and discovered that there's something called analytics or data and analytics. What's interesting to me is that they didn't necessarily call it statistics. And so words started popping up called data science or analytics or terms like that. Data engineering is a term that's out there. And I would say that the business world in general is kind of rediscovering many of the things that that we've done in the past in statistics and just trying to apply it in a new light. Now, as far as your question about the pharmaceutical industry, yes, I do think that the pharmaceutical industry has been a little bit slow to get engaged with this. And I think there's some reasons for it that kind of makes sense, in that, you know, pharmaceutical products aren't sold directly to consumers. And so a lot of the, you know, from the pharmaceutical company to the consumer, right? It's prescribed by a physician. It's, you know, purchased maybe through a hospital pharmacy or some other retail pharmacy. Or in the United States, there's insurance companies that get involved and benefit managers and that kind of stuff. So it's different. I think the other parts of the business world came to this more quickly because they sell products directly to consumers, and they can learn about their consumers and their consumer behaviors and likes and preferences. Whereas on the pharmaceutical side, there's other intermediaries in the process of a drug getting from a company to a patient.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is also that we have actually sales reps that visit the physicians on a regular basis. And that is not true in lots of other business-to-customer kind of settings.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, like I said, there's intermediaries, and we try to influence these intermediaries, you know, sales reps who influence doctors, or health outcomes people who maybe try to influence pharmacy, the people who make decisions about what drugs get on the pharmacy list and things like that. So it's a more complicated game. But nonetheless, I think the pharma industry in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years has really started to think about this more deeply and figure out how can we use data and analytics to help us in different ways to optimize our business.
So speaking about optimization of business, what kind of data is collected in these parts of the business that we are speaking about? And which areas are we actually talking about?
So I guess I'll talk broadly about commercial statistics. And while I know this is sponsored by PSI, and Alexander, you're speaking to me from Germany, I would have to confess that the vast majority of my experience has been in the U.S. world, where there's more complex systems. There aren't single payer systems or country systems like there are in many parts of Europe. And so some of the data that's collected is, you know, information on doctors and their prescribing habits. How often do they prescribe drug A versus drug B versus drug C? And what do we know? We collect data about our sales reps and how often do they call on certain doctors. We might even have web pages set up to promote our new treatments, and we can track who clicks on those web pages, who gives us information, how often do they click, et cetera. And so through a variety of means, we're collecting data about all these different dimensions of the marketplace. And of course, ultimately doing very similar things to what we do in clinical trials, where we try to assess the cause and effect, the cause being a treatment and the effect being a clinical outcome, trying to understand what causes affects prescribing behavior, whether it's a television advertisement, a sales call, a magazine advertisement, a conference presentation. What are those complex mix of causes actually influence a doctor's prescribing behavior? So it's still about cause and effect. It's just a more complicated world. Again, I speak primarily about the United States, which I know most, but I'm sure there's analogies in other markets as well.
Yeah, I think the US has a couple of advantages in terms of having a first focus in terms of business analytics. So first, it's a very, very large homogeneous market. So if you have sales initiatives, you can actually test that in different areas and compare different areas because you have a very large pool to actually select from. The other point is it's very homogeneous from a regulatory and data privacy perspective, and also how data is collected, commercial data is collected. It's very, very homogeneous. That's another opportunity. And lastly, of course, it's just a very, very large market. So all these things come together. That's why it's natural to first focus on these areas. There's also a couple of differences in terms of how you can link prescriptions to a specific customer, which is easier in the US than in most of the other parts of the world, where that is much more challenging. So in other parts of the world, you may need to look into more kind of surrogate markets like surveys that you conduct with physicians or with other healthcare providers to understand whether they understand the benefits of your drug, or whether they see the benefits of the drug, or whether they actually know about the drug at all, if you have a new drug on the market. So there's lots of differences in these kind of settings around the world.
Yeah, I would say the only thing where I might point out to any people listening to this is that the homogeneity that you reference in the United States, it does exist on some levels. There are definitely federal regulations, rules, laws, or whatever governing some of these activities, but there's still an awful lot of heterogeneity in that we have a competitive business market for health insurance. And so there are many different health insurance companies who have different ways of covering treatments or tracking patients or different levels of sophistication for how they collect data. And even how they store that data, the nomenclature associated with variables in those data sets, et cetera. And so integrating some of that data or trying to interpret it can be difficult because there are certainly many aspects of the healthcare market that are fragmented in the United States as well. So, yes, there is homogeneity from certain national perspectives, but still quite a bit of heterogeneity and many challenges because of the fragmented insurance and healthcare delivery market that happens in the United States.
Yeah, that's really a good point. If you look, for example, in certain European countries where the health insurance is government-owned, mostly or completely, then of course this layer of complexity is taken away, at least within this country. Of course, you then have still kind of the between country heterogeneity. Yeah. You may also mentioned web pages and I guess that also then goes into social media, email marketing, webinar marketing, all these kind of other kind of e-commerce activities that pharma companies are stepping more and more into. Is that also data area that is growing from your perspective?
Yes, I would say that that's definitely true. Some people, you might refer to these as interventions. That might be a sophisticated term that we use in the medical world about interventions into someone's disease or whatever. But there are interventions in the commercialization world too, or many different ways that you can, say, touch a potential prescriber. You mentioned some of those, but there's even more. Companies have lunch and learn sessions that they host. They may have conferences where they have maybe sometimes pretty large, kind of seminars about a disease state or maybe specifically about their drugs. Yes, you can sign up for pushes, from people's, the company can send out pushes to doctors about new information if they want to sign up and get new information. There's all sorts of different ways anymore that you can touch a physician or a prescriber, and they all come with different costs. They all come with different levels of impact. And I know, Alexander, you've been involved in late stage clinical kind of development and interactions with health technology assessments and payers and whatnot. And I know you understand and appreciate the very observational nature of the data. And I would say the commercial world definitely has this very observational nature of sales of your product or prescribing, maybe going up or down. And there's all sorts of things going on in the marketplace, not only commercial things you're trying to do with advertising or sales force or whatnot, but that competitors are doing as well. And so trying to tease out the cause and effect of where should I invest my marketing dollar? Should it be more in magazine ads or television ads or conference seminars or lunch and learn sessions or hire more sales reps to visit the doctors on a more regular basis? All of those things are kind of potential ways that you can invest the next $10 million you have for marketing of your product. And the question that is starting to come up, and where I've seen at least my experience at Lilly with some of our statisticians and some people in my group, were commercial folks saying, what's the best way to allocate that $10 million? What would give me the best ROI? Can you tell me whether these methods work, for this kind of drug or in this kind of physician population? So yeah, there's kind of mixed models that people run, and they use observational research methods and try to do some of these causal effect things, just like in medical research, phase four or observational research. But the interventions are different, and the measured or desired outcomes are something related to prescribing or market share or revenue or things like that.
So it could be just kind of you attend or you net attend a webinar or something like this, and you see what is the difference in terms of prescription, or what is the difference in terms of recall on the sales message, or what is the kind of attitudes that the people have towards the company, all kind of different data that you can look into. And then, of course, attending the webinar is not randomized. There's where kind of the observational nature comes into, and you work with propensity scores and all these kind of different things. Yeah, exactly. But
yeah, people will actually use the phrase propensity to prescribe, right, when they talk about it. So some of the language is very similar to the R&D or medical research world. It's just how to apply it in a different setting of interventions, outcomes, and whatnot.
Yeah, but I know that there's also randomized experiments. So I actually ran some randomized experiments recently with my email list, where I wrote two different email headers and then sent them out at random to a subset of my email list, looking into, okay, what is the better performance in terms of the open rate, and then the rest of the email list got the better performing subject line. I think there are similar things that you can do also in the business world, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you a story that early in our days of getting involved with business analytics a number of years ago, I was involved in a meeting with some folks who were arguing about a marketing message for one of our products. And there were some people who felt like the lead part of the message should be about the efficacy of this compound and how well it performed. And then a secondary kind of message in the advertising, whether it was print advertising or advertising that was on radio or TV, the secondary part of the message would be about, oh, and this drug is safe and it's been tested in clinical trials, blah, blah, blah. Others felt the other way, that first, you have to convince people that this product is safe, it's been tested and approved by the FDA, et cetera. And that should be the leading message to get everybody thinking, okay, here's a safe product, and then follow with the efficacy is as good as or better than competitors or whatnot. And there was this debate arguing, you know, and people saying, well, from my experience, this, and somebody else, well, yeah, but remember this product. And I remember being involved in, I kind of called a timeout in the meeting and said, you know, we don't have to weigh everybody's opinions or see who can argue the loudest over this. Why don't we just do an experiment where we randomize, construct your messages, two different messages, and we'll randomize the sales force to deliver these messages to different, you know, to the different doctors that they visit. And we'll construct the randomization in a way that, you know, it's balanced by geography in the U.S. or it's balanced by private hospitals versus public hospitals. You know, we can design an experiment to try to balance some of these other, you know, confounding factors, if you will, or baseline characteristics. Mm-hmm. And then let's do the randomization. And then let's measure sales in these different areas over the course of 3, 4, 6 months. And let's let the data tell us which message resonates best. And after some convincing and effort, that played out. And as I recall in that particular example, one message did a little better than another, but it wasn't substantially so, significantly so. And So we went with a message that was actually delivering slightly better results. But I think there was a lesson kind of learned by all, that we can sit around and pontificate and argue and describe our biases and our experiences about what will work and tell each other what we think others will do and how they'll respond. But let the data speak. Let's do the experiment and let the data speak. And some of those approaches became a little bit more routine. And I know Eli Lilly has done that kind of work in the past. And I suspect, though I'm no longer there, I suspect that they're still doing controlled experiments to help nail down various aspects of how to best optimize their marketing messages and marketing spend.
Yeah, and you can do these in all kind of different settings. You can do this, you know, in terms of your homepage, in terms of different things you hand out by the sales reps, all kind of different things you can do. You just need to make sure that you have a good kind of follow-up in terms of what your endpoint is. The really, really interesting thing about this is also that it's not so much about that you want to show a statistically significant difference, because basically from a kind of cost perspective, both interventions are the same, whether you have that message first or the other message first, there's no kind of cost associated to it. So you just want to know what's better, yeah, or what's likely to be better. And so that's a very, very interesting, different thinking about it.
Yes, and I will also say that we actually did some factorial experiments as well, that, you know, the combination of a sales rep visit followed by an email, or an email followed by a sales rep's visit, to see, you know, some people got the email, some people got a sales rep, some got both, some got one first, some got the other, to see if there's some sort of interaction between some of these factors as well. So we also began to explore some kind of factorial experiments to understand, does it make a difference? And if it makes a difference, you know, is the doctor more likely to remember or to prescribe more when there's an email followed up to a sales visit, or whether there's a sales visit followed up to an email or something like that. So you can imagine experimental design, you know, playing a larger and larger role. It's kind of hard to do. It's harder to do than when you're in a lab in R&D, but certainly the ground is very fertile out there, I think, in pharmaceutical commercial business, for doing controlled experiments and factorial experiments and other kinds of experimental designs that we perhaps all learned in school, but apply it to the commercial setting to figure out how to optimize your message, your dollars, and your allocation of resources.
So basically, from a, let's say, purely mathematical point of view, statisticians should be quite nicely equipped to help in these other fields and drive forward their innovations and better understanding of data. But what would you see is, you know, lacking in, let's say, the usual medical statisticians, if I call them that way, that would hinder him to actually be successful in these areas?
Yes, I think there are definitely areas where some of the underlying mathematics or statistical thinking or whatever around design or recognizing and eliminating bias or things like that that we're taught to think through, those things can definitely apply. But I do think there's different kind of learnings that have to go on. I think we all recognize that the effective statistician in the medical arena, if that statistician is assigned to oncology projects or autoimmune or Alzheimer's disease, that it's incumbent on them to learn about Alzheimer's disease, how it's treated, what physicians look for, what does the healthcare system, reimburse for, or learning all of that stuff. What are the regulatory requirements or restrictions or precedents? You have to learn all that to be an effective statistician in the medical arena if you're going to play on the Alzheimer's team or some oncology team or whatever. And I think it's no different in the business world. It takes time, but you have to learn their lingo. You have to learn the constraints. You have to learn how drugs are, how they actually get from your manufacturing facility into a patient's hand. And what are all those different touch points and handoffs? You got to understand government rules and regulations or hospital formularies. All of those kinds of things are important to know. And so in one sense, I'd say it's no different. If you're going to be an effective statistician in any area, you've got to learn the language, the environment, the subject matter to which you're applying your statistics. And it's no different in the business world. There's different things you have to learn, but you're going to have to sit down and learn those things. And it may be that somebody coming out of school with a business statistics degree is more readily equipped and knows the lingo and knows things about how business people think better than somebody who maybe, like myself, originally got a degree in biostatistics and learned a lot about clinical trials and clinical data and statistical methods, you know, related to that. But it's not impossible. I think statisticians can make that shift. And I certainly saw it at Eli Lilly where people made the shift from the medical world to the commercial world and did so quite successfully because they were very strong in their statistical knowledge and understanding statistical principles, et cetera.
So one challenge that I could foresee is that for lots of the, let's say, medical data, it's kind of common sense that you as a statistician need to be involved. It's kind of your default member of the team. And that may not necessarily be traditionally the case for these business areas. Did you see any kind of particular challenges with that for statisticians to kind of first explain what they actually bring to the table and that they needed first to convince and show their value?
I would say yes, definitely. The folks that we worked with, very understandably so, were slightly suspicious. They were kind of cautiously optimistic because unless you had lived in a cave for the last 10 years, they'd all heard of big data and analytics, and they knew this. They knew these areas were important, and they had all gone to business school and read case studies about, the successes that Amazon had, or different banks or companies, So they always felt like, I kind of felt like they were ready for something and they wanted something, but simultaneously they were nervous, more nervous than in R&D, because they were suspicious of, okay, here comes a bunch of PhD folks. And while having a PhD in an R&D setting in a pharma company, is very common, whether it's in biology or chemistry or medicine or whatever, it's not very common in the business world. And so there was always this kind of confidence that you had to gain from them that you're not going to do some pie in the sky, ivory tower, sophisticated thing that doesn't have any practical application, or that, me as a business person, I could never understand what you're doing, and I don't trust what you're doing, and I don't believe in it because it's not, you really don't understand the practicalities of business, and gee, your models are great, but they're really not that great for the kinds of things I want to do. So there was this kind of push and pull of, I want some help. I know this is important. I think this is a big deal, but a little bit of hesitancy and suspicion that somehow, we in the statistics profession or whatever might try to smother everybody with confusion and cleverness and really not help them, address the business questions that they had. So there were definitely a growing process where we had over time had to gain confidence, but as we demonstrated value, as we made predictions, as we built models, as we helped answer questions with reliability, the business people started to turn to us more and more and say, hey, I need help with this, or I have this question. Do you have any ideas? How should we go about doing this or whatever? So, yeah, it definitely took some time. But and some were much more receptive than others, right?
Yeah, and I think with these kind of quick wins, you can, build trust and go on and build further trust and get allies on the business side that speak in favor of you to their peers. And with that, you get the ball rolling more and more, I guess.
Yes. I will say one other thing, Alexander, is I think a big difference from the medical world and the clinical development world that many statisticians and pharma are in, I would say it is the problems in the paths forward are more obvious than in the commercial or manufacturing or, areas of the business outside of R&D. And I don't want to minimize what the medical statisticians do. I was one of those. I grew up in that world, and I know it's pretty doggone complicated. But to be honest, when you're studying a new oncology drug, you're pretty much looking at things like progression-free for survival and overall survival, right? When you're looking at, a psoriasis drug or a rheumatoid arthritis drug, there are well-defined measures that have been used by regulatory agencies and clinical trialists for years and years. Mm. And you might tweak a patient population some, or you've got to understand dose and all that stuff. But I can tell you there were times in the manufacturing world or in the commercialization, the launch of a new product, where the questions are vague or they're, I want to do this better, but it's hard to describe what this is and it's hard to describe what better is. And furthermore, it's hard to understand how to measure whatever better is and what data would help me understand, am I doing this better or not? And so So you kind of got to have a very creative, open mind to help people formulate the problems. In the medical world, you know you got to do a phase 3 trial. It's probably going to be randomized between a treatment and a control of some sort. You know what the outcomes are. The regulators say you have to do a 52-week trial minimum or whatever. You got to have so many patients in your safety database. There's certain parameters that are very well defined. Whereas in the commercial world, it's kind of wide open. All of those things are kind of up for grabs and for discussion and for definition or whatnot. So in that sense, I do think it takes maybe a different level of listening and creativity to help find some solutions for people in the business world.
Yeah, just as we talked about, kind of even the intervention itself can have so many different aspects, you know, far more different aspects than let's say, most of the therapies we know of. Of course, there's more complex therapies and less complex therapies, but very often it's maybe just about the dose, yeah? And maybe you can complicate it a little bit with taking it in the morning or in the evening or these kind of things. But generally, if you think about marketing interventions, they are so manifold, you know, even about kind of, if you think about how you can, in how many different ways you can set up a web page, it's, you know, even the dimensions are infinite.
Yeah. And the scales are markedly different. And by that, I mean, in the United States, if you want to do a television advertising campaign, you're likely spending tens of millions of dollars on that. It's a lot easier to do an email campaign, right? You spend a little time thinking about and constructing an email, and it costs virtually nothing to blast that out to thousands, tens of thousands of doctors or prescribers. But then measuring the return on that investment and whatnot. So you can, you know, in that sense, I think there's levels of complexity that don't quite exist in the clinical trial world on that kind of a scale.
So in terms of the statisticians, let's say coming back to them, you mentioned a couple of colleagues that went from the medical side more into the business side, and you also yourself dived into that. What was kind of from your personal background or from stories that you heard from colleagues, that what made them go into these other areas? What kind of attracted them to go there?
Yeah. So, first, I will say, and this answer might be a little bit long, so feel free to interrupt me, Alexander, and ask more questions. But when I was running advanced analytics, when we were getting that started inside Lilly, it was focused largely, almost exclusively on R&D kinds of stuff, and within R&D, almost exclusively on clinical trials, because that's where some of the big, most important and expensive issues are. And I can tell you that the CEO of our company came to visit my group after we had been in existence for a couple years and had some pretty good success stories to share. He wanted to come and visit with us. And he said, as you might hear many business folks say, use the phrase, follow the money. Where do we spend the most money? And he said, we actually spend the most money in commercialization and launching new products. The second most is in clinical development. The third most is in manufacturing. So follow the money, like start thinking about where you can get involved in the commercial side of things. And I was fortunate enough that at the time, the person who was running the U.S. business was very open-minded to analytics. And after a series of conversations with him and sharing some examples and showing some stories or copying him on some stories that were written in business magazines about successes and the use of data, he became very interested in like, let's do this, Steve. Let's do analytics for our business or whatnot. And it was a learning experience for me. And I said, okay, you know, I don't know exactly how to do this. I got a couple people who are curious, but we just need to sit down with some of your business people and start asking questions like what things Where do you think you need help? What questions don't you have answers to? Where do you think you're wasting money, or you think you could spend money better or differently? Let's just have those conversations. And he recognized that we were all kind of new at it, and his other business folks did too. And so it took some time for us to learn the language, to learn how the commercial systems worked, and how payers and insurers and hospitals, you know, made decisions about which medications to buy or to prescribe for patients. It just followed the process, like I said, of a medical statistician who might be involved with, you know, breast cancer research or whatever, and they have to learn all the different kinds of breast cancer and treatment types and paradigms and, you know, whatnot and patient populations. They have to learn all that. We went through that same kind of learning process. I think it's very, very doable. And it just takes a statistician who is curious and interested. And thankfully, I had a few statisticians who were very curious and interested to take their lives and career in a whole new direction. With that said, there were times when internal statisticians, medical statisticians at Lilly, when we had openings and we asked if some of the medical statisticians wanted to apply or whatnot, there were many times where they were like, no, I don't want to go down that path. That's so different or so new or whatever that they didn't want to do it. So it does take a kind of a little bit of a special person who has a curiosity, a willingness for some discomfort, because you're moving into an area where you now have very little expertise and may need to learn an awful lot. But that willingness to collaborate, to learn, and to admit that maybe you're wrong and try something else new and learn again. So, I mean, that's the path I followed. I just continually talked to people, asked questions, and tried to have the business folks focus on important business questions, not what analysis should we do, but what question do you have? What problem do you have? What answer do you need? And if I can understand that, then I can go back and work with others to figure out what data should we collect or what analyses should we do with our existing data to help get a meaningful answer to those questions. So anyway, those are a few thoughts on that in that line.
Yeah, I love the story with the money. I once remember I was talking to marketeer, and he mentioned to me, I know that 50% of the money I'm spending is wasted. I just don't know which 50%.
Yeah, right.
And kind of helping him with these kind of things and stopping those things that are ineffective makes a huge difference. And of course, if you spend less money on marketing, or you spend it more effectively, you have more money for further R&D.
or for other more effective marketing techniques, right? The more money in the system to do whatever, to reinvest in more important or more valuable activities rather than wasted stuff.
Yeah, and important thing about this, I think many people think that marketing is just to kind of influence or bias physician or something like this. For me, it is very different. For me, it is first and foremost help understand the different decision makers to make the best decisions. And that is one of the key things I think about. And therefore, it really helps patients in the end.
Yeah, you know, speaking of waste, if you'll allow me to tell a little story that is in the public domain, mm-hmm. From Eli Lilly, and it gets to your question about how do you make this transition, from maybe the medical arena to the business or commercial or manufacturing arena. I can tell you there was one point in time where Lilly was working on a product, an oncology product that came in a 5-milligram vial. And as the company was scaling up to more clinical trials and looking for other doses or whatever that they might give, they said, well, let's add a 10-milligram vial to this you know, to, for this product. And then when we do our clinical trial, we'll have a little more flexibility for some larger doses and whatnot. And it just took a curious person to ask the question in a meeting when that was being discussed. A statistician happened to be there, wasn't one of my statisticians per se, but one of the team statisticians, who just innocently asked, why 10 milligrams? Where did that come from? And why do you think that's the best dosage vial to have? And everybody said, well, you know, it'll allow us to, you know, increase the dose and we can put combinations of 10 and 5 milligrams together and, you know, study more doses and all that. And the statistician just simply said, well, do you mind if we take a look at this and just see maybe is there a different way to think about this? And it led down a path of wastage with oncology products, which are very expensive. So, for example, if you have a 5 and 10 milligram vial, you have to use a, well, let's just say, yeah, 5 and a 10 milligram vial. If a patient is dosed on a body surface or weight milligram per kilogram basis, which is usually the case in oncology, let's just say it works out that they need 6 milligrams. Well, you would use your 10 milligram vial and throw, give the patient 6 and throw 4 milligrams away. And when you start to think about it, the question becomes, what's the right combination of vial dosage strengths to minimize wastage in patients? And this led to a whole study of what's the average body weight of patients with this kind of particular tumor? And if we wanted to minimize wastage, what should we do? And it turned out that adding a 10 milligram vial to a 5 milligram vial really did very, very little. And when you sit back and think about it, it's they're multiples of each other. And what you want is you want vial dosages that are not multiples of each other so that when you put combinations together, you can cover a lot more possible doses. It turned out that the optimal combinations was a 3 milligram vial and a 4 milligram vial. And with 3 and 4 milligrams, you can virtually get exactly what you want in terms of dosing patients. But as we went down this path, there's all sorts of other constraints, like you're not allowed to use more than 4 vials per patient because it's too cumbersome for the pharmacy or the nurse or the doctor or whoever. And these vials, these containers only come in certain volumes. And the drug can only be concentrated in a certain range in order for it to stay in solution. And you got to have enough headspace in each vial because they fill up a little gap of headspace between the solution and the vial cap with nitrogen because it helps preserve the stability of the molecule. So now all of a sudden, you've got these constraints of, you know, you got to buy different equipment to handle these different size vials and fill them different volumes. And so it led one of our people to a huge optimization problem of, given all these other constraints, what are the optimal vial strengths that should be used to minimize wastage of oncology doses or treatments or whatever, which is a very, very expensive wastage. And all of that work, one example of that work was actually published in the Journal of Medical Economics. And if anybody wanted to look it up, it was published in 2018. The Journal of Medical Economics, the lead author is a woman named Lisa Hess, and it talks about drug wastage and cost to the healthcare system, you know, when using an oncology treatment.
And we can put that to the show notes. So if you go to the show notes, you can find that there. Yeah.
Awesome. So you can see, again, it's a different mindset of asking questions and digging in and trying to figure out. The problems are a bit more nebulous and not as clear. As I said, in some of the medical arena, again, I don't want to imply that it's simple there, but when somebody studies the next rheumatoid arthritis drug, there's been a lot of rheumatoid arthritis drugs that have been studied and a lot of precedents, and people pretty much understand the regulatory environment and the medical environment and what needs to be done to have trials that would be considered producing substantial evidence of effectiveness and safety.
So what I really love about the story is the initial question. Where's this coming from? This curiosity, this kind of really wanting to understand where it's coming from and having this enough know-how to know that it's not a kind of complete random question. That is a really, really nice way. And it shows that asking the right question is sometimes much more powerful than having the right answers.
Yes, it's very true. It's kind of the art of asking the right question, or being able to ask enough questions to get at kind of the essence of what you're trying to do. I have many other examples of where the statisticians were kind of in a meeting or in a place and just kind of said, well, why are you doing it that way? Or why would you assume this? Or why is that the decision you're making? And just by asking that question sparks a conversation and a more in-depth analysis or whatever that led to some counterintuitive solutions or answers at time, or different answers at least than what was maybe being done kind of based on tradition and history and whatnot.
Yeah. So in terms of all the kind of advantages, all the kind of different challenges, we talked a lot about that. Now, if the listener of this podcast wants to dive into this field, how can he best learn more about this field?
Well, I think I initially, my learning came from reading literature that was outside the medical world. I think I have a kind of a general natural kind of broad curiosity. In the United States, I subscribe to Business Week, and I read Business Week every week, right? And there I would read some pretty amazing stories and think about, well, gee, there's an analogy to that in the pharma industry with how this company standardized some sort of data and they did this to, you know, identify better customers or processes or optimize something within their company. And so some of it just came from reading things that are outside the medical world, reading some business books. You know, there's plenty of business books that describe some of these things, like From Good to Great, or, there's a book, Blown to Bits, The Economics of Information. And So some of it's just reading that and becoming more familiar with the business world. If you're in a company right now and you want to get engaged, I would say if you're a medical statistician, maybe particularly if you're in some late stages of your clinical development or phase three kinds of stuff, maybe ask to get connected to the people who are the marketing leaders or the launch leaders, to learn about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And then asking those questions. I know one thing that can be a very nice transition for somebody in the clinical medical development world that leads to the marketing is, how are we going to launch this? How are we going to launch this particular treatment? And what I mean by how are we going to launch it, like, where are we going to launch it first? Or who are we going to launch it to? Maybe there's, I don't know, tens of thousands of rheumatologists in the United States. Are you going to try to launch it to all of them simultaneously? Or are you going to focus on certain rheumatologists to get the message out? Are they thought leaders or are they high prescribers? We did some work where we actually looked at classifying doctors into early adopters versus late adopters. And we certainly found that there are certainly doctors in the United States who never prescribed a new medication until it had been on the market for 2 years. Maybe they're just more cautious and they take a wait and see. And we found other doctors who, you know, when new drugs come on the market, they're the first ones to try it. They want to give their patients this new medication. They themselves want to learn about how it works, et cetera. And so you start to ask yourself, how do I identify those kinds of doctors? And you start to ask, how are we going to launch this product? And who are we going to target our messages to? So that could be a natural transition, because a person working in phase three trials, and particularly analyzing and making submissions to regulatory agencies, obviously they know a lot of the ins and outs of the treatment. And it might be a natural transition for them to work with some marketing folks to say, okay, who are you targeting, or how can I help you analyze data? to understand where we might get the biggest bang for our buck in the early days of this launch. No need having sales reps or advertising messages directed at these guys who never prescribe a drug until it's been on the market for a couple years, right? It's just wasted time and money and effort. Yep. So those are the kinds of things where you might be able to start to get involved and show some value very early on, and some maybe some quicker wins, and then you know, open the door to more opportunities.
I completely agree. I have worked with sales and marketing very, very closely in the last years at Lilly, and that helped me to understand lots about our business. Also, you know, I had once a day with a sales rep in the field, and that opened my eyes of how our data that we, you know, generate in clinical trials actually is communicated to the physician in a one-to-one setting. And all these kind of things really help you understand where you can have an impact. And another kind of nice area where you can learn about statistical engagement in these more commercial activities is also the upcoming PSI webinar. So if you listen to this before the 12th of March 2019, you can register on the PSI homepage for this webinar. It's free for all PSI members and a little nominal charge for non-PSI members. So hopefully you become a PSI member. And it has three great speakers that will speak about the different aspects of business analytics. So Camilo Zapata, who is actually a former Lilly colleague that also worked in Steve's group, will introduce into the field of business analytics within the context of pharmaceutical companies. Then Elena Baptista, who's still working at Lilly, will talk about how we can measure the effectiveness of our communications. And we talked a lot about that during the interview today. And finally, Lucy from GSK will speak about communicating efficacy data in a manner appropriate for healthcare professionals. So lots of different topics that you can learn about on the 12th of March. And finally, I want to give you a final hint. The special interest group for data science has just started within PSI, and I will give the details of how to connect there in the show notes. So just go to the show notes and you'll find all the CSR materials there. So with that, you have a couple of action items, very practical ones from both Steve and myself that you can follow up on this webinar. And with that, I want to say a big thank you to Steve. It was a great interview. I didn't expect anything different to that based on the presentation at PSI and all the other presentations I have seen. And yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Alexander. Thank you, Alexander, for giving me the opportunity to speak with you. I've enjoyed this. And I hope your listeners get some valuable information out of this and help expand and improve the influence of statistics in the pharmaceutical industry more broadly.
Absolutely. And I think that was also a really, really nice part in your presentation in Amsterdam at the PSI conference, where you talked about different ingredients that you need to actually change in this direction. And if you're missing one of these ingredients, that leads to frustration or false starts or whatever. So I still remember this really, really nice part. So
And I think, Alexander, just as another plug, that keynote talk is also on the PSI website recorded, is it not?
Exactly. So if you go to the video on demand area of the PSI website, you can find that talk as well. And I will put that into the show notes as well. Awesome.
Okay. Thank you again, Alexander, and all the best to you.
Thanks so much. Bye. This show was created in association with PSI. Next week, we'll talk about cluster analysis, so a typical data science approach. Thanks for listening. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes that we mentioned in the episode today and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector.